welcome to the political cesspool, known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host for tonight, James Edwards.
Well, I might weigh a little more than I did a week ago, but I am still James Edwards, and I'm here to welcome you to another live installment of our award-winning show, The Political Cesspool Radio Program. It is Saturday, November 28th. We are live, unrehearsed, and uncensored, God knows, as we come to you from AM 1380 WLRM Radio in Memphis, Tennessee, and going out over the internet at thepoliticalcesspool.org, our official internet headquarters, and libertynewsradio.com. And, of course, the great network that is Liberty News Radio syndicates us to their affiliates across the country, and we invite you to take a look at their station listing. You may also be tuned in via satellite or over the phone. However you're here, welcome, welcome, welcome. It's 2 days after Thanksgiving, 1 day after Black Friday, and here we are again. Keith Alexander with me during tonight's first hour, and we have a great show lined up for you, ladies and gentlemen. Keith, how are you tonight?
I'm great. I tell you, there's nothing like a four-day weekend to allow you to unwind and recharge your batteries, is it?
No, there's not, Keith. I think we should do this more often.
Yeah, I tell you what, maybe the Europeans are on to something with these four-day work weeks. Yeah.
Well, hell, you know, the euro is worth more than the dollar, so they got to be on to something. But, in fact, with this being a semi-holiday type show, not the entire show, but for the most part, we're going to have a relaxed evening. We're still going to hit some hard topics, but coming up during the second hour, for example, we're going to be talking with one of our premier sponsors, Mr. Scott Goldsmith. He is the owner and proprietor of Dixie Republic, right there in Travelers Rest, South Carolina. This is a Confederate partisan's superstore, and we are now approaching the Christmas season. And if you have to immerse yourself in the trivial trappings of Christmas, which includes buying gifts for everyone, and let's face it, we all do that. It's not the reason for the season, but it's a fun part of it nonetheless. Instead of buying your friends and family gifts they don't need or don't want, how about giving them something, a gift with meaning this year, something that would allow them to showcase their Southern pride? We're going to talk to Scott Goldsmith during tonight's second hour to get you on the right track as you begin your Christmas shopping, and we're going to direct you to a store. You can place your orders over the internet. It's Dixie Republic, and you're going to be excited when you hear what all they've got in their inventory. So that's coming up, just like I said, a little more relaxed tonight in the cesspool, but certainly we're still going to give you some of the serious topics that we always do. Keith, was talking about Thanksgiving. How was yours?
I tell you, it was, right out of Norman Vincent Peale. We went down the country to my mother-in-law's house and met there. You know, all of her children and their families came there, and everybody was there, and it was a great time.
Yeah, I try to take care of myself, but way too much eating since Thursday. I had not one, not even two, but three Thanksgiving dinners. One with my side of the family, one with my wife's side of the family, and then one with just my parents and my wife and my brother, a little close, closed door Thanksgiving. On the first of the three, my aunt was in charge of cooking the turkey. She put the turkey in at about 2 o'clock on Wednesday. We started on Wednesday. Our Thanksgiving started on Wednesday, then Thursday, then Friday. But she put the turkey in at 2. It was supposed to be done around 6. We were going to eat at 7. She went to check the turkey at 5 and realized she forgot to turn on the oven.
Oh.
So the first Edwards Thanksgiving celebration consisted of Kentucky Fried Chicken as the main course. But we made do, and I tell you what, it wasn't too bad of a substitute. But we got our turkey on Thanksgiving Day, so it all worked out.
Well,
and it wasn't really good.
Actually,
Keith, I
got to
tell you,
dinners.
It was one of the best Thanksgivings I've had in a number of years. For the first time in quite a while, there's no family member that's extremely ill, and it was just very relaxed. Everybody was getting along, and you know how it is with family. Sometimes that doesn't happen, but very good Thanksgiving on this end. I'm glad to know that yours was as well, my friend, and I hope that everybody out there in our listening audience had a very enjoyable and blessed Thanksgiving. And
you're the only guy I know, James.
Yeah, go ahead.
You're the only guy I know that could eat three Thanksgiving dinners, and I know that you ate a full dinner at every one of those stops. You've got the metabolism of a shrew. I think you eat your body weight, once every 24 hours, don't you?
Yeah, something like that, Keith, but I'll tell you one thing, and this won't come as a surprise to you, as you and I have lunch just about every week, if not twice a week. I had three full Thanksgiving dinners, but I didn't eat one vegetable during the course of it.
Right.
I'm very proud about that.
Yeah, I remember you're famous for the comment one time, "I'm so hungry I could eat a vegetable."
I've never been that hungry, Keith. But listen, on the theme of
you beat Ronald Reagan to the punch. He caught some flack for saying that ketchup was a vegetable. You've always considered it one of your primary vegetables, right?
Well, listen, I do eat ketchup, so if it is a vegetable, that'll be the only one that I did eat. But nevertheless, while we're talking about Thanksgiving, and before we have to shift gears, of course, work must intrude, even on holiday weekends of our program. Before work intrudes, then we have to start talking about more serious issues. And this is serious, I guess. I want to read to you, I want to share with you, President George Washington's first Thanksgiving Day proclamation. And I got this from European Americans United, and I want to echo what Western Voices World News says. There wasn't a word about Indians and pilgrims allegedly sitting down for the first Thanksgiving dinner. And with that being said, this is what President George Washington had to say. And as I read this, compare and contrast the America as we knew it upon its inception and what America has devolved into today as I read George Washington's Thanksgiving Day proclamation. It says this: "General Thanksgiving by the President of the United States of America, a proclamation. Whereas it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor, and whereas both houses of Congress have, by their joint committee, requested me to recommend the people of the United States a day of public thanksgiving and prayer, to be observed by acknowledging with grateful hearts the many and signal favors of Almighty God, especially by affording them an opportunity peaceably to establish a form of government for their safety and happiness. Now, therefore, I do recommend and assign Thursday, the 26th day of November next, to be devoted by the people of these states to the service that great and glorious being who is the beneficent author of all that is good, that was, that is, or that will be, that we may then all unite in rendering unto Him our sincere and humble thanks for His kind care and protection of the people of this country previous to their becoming a nation, for the signal and manifold mercies and the favorable interpositions of His providence in the course and conclusion of the late war, for the great degree of tranquility, union, and plenty which we have since enjoyed, for the peaceable and rational manner in which we have been able to establish constitutions of government for our safety and happiness, and particularly the national one now lately instituted, for the civil and religious liberty which we are blessed with, and the means we have of acquiring and diffusing useful knowledge, and in general, for all the great and various favors which He has been pleased to confer upon us, and also that we may then unite in most humbly offering our prayers and supplications to the great Lord and ruler of nations, and beseech Him to pardon our national and other transgressions, to enable us, whether public or private stations, to perform our several and relative duties properly and punctually, to render our national government a blessing to all the people by constantly being a government of wise, just, and constitutional laws, discreetly and faithfully executed and obeyed, to protect and guide all sovereign nations, and to bless them with good governments, peace, and concord, to promote the knowledge and practice of true religion and virtue, and the increase of science among them and us, and generally to grant unto all mankind such a degree of temporal prosperity as He alone knows best, given under my hand at the city of New York, the third day of October, in the year of our Lord, 1789, signed G. Washington. So, Keith, on October 3rd, 1789, we know what George Washington was doing. And I wonder if Barack Obama, the president who proclaimed that America is not, never has been, a Christian nation, I wonder if he's ever read George Washington's Thanksgiving Proclamation.
I very much doubt it. That certainly does give the lie to the notion of separation of church and state, doesn't it? And also
absolutely,
that the founding fathers were these devotees of the French Enlightenment that really weren't involved at all and that weren't committed Christians. That's another one of the myths that the left is wants to foist upon the American people. But it's quite obvious from that passage that you just read that Christianity and Christ were first and foremost in the hearts and minds of the founding fathers.
Well, and George Washington said it was with the unanimous joint consent of both houses of Congress that that proclamation be issued in so many words. And, you know, obviously our listening audience, there are members of our listening audience who have different religious affiliations or lack thereof. But be that as it may, I still think it's important and incumbent upon us to know the true origins of this country because, I mean, Keith, you compare where we are now to where we were then and doesn't even feel, I mean, it is not the same. It's not the same government, to be sure. But we got to take a break. We'll be back right after this.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
Don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood.
Please don't understand me, baby.
Don't let me be misunderstood.
Don't misunderstand.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Hope you enjoyed that reading of the original George Washington Thanksgiving Day proclamation. I tried to read that as best and as fluidly as I could. It was written in that old English with, of course, they wrote a little more eloquently than we do now with a little more panache, but I tried to read that as best I could. If you want to read it for yourself, and I think everyone should, I don't know if there's a school in the country who read that this year. It would be interesting to know if any of our listeners had kids that are in school in which they studied the original Thanksgiving Day Proclamation. Certainly a very important document in the history of this country because it set up the Thanksgiving tradition that we celebrate every year. But nevertheless, if you want to read it for yourself, go to Western Voices World News. That's where I got it from, WVWnews.net. And that being said, we're shifting gears now. We're actually going to revisit a topic that we covered extensively last week, a topic that we covered for nearly the entire first hour, and we typically don't spend this much time, this much airtime invested in a single topic, but because we scooped everyone with it last week and because it is making quite a few waves throughout the popular culture of America, we are going to revisit it at least for a few minutes tonight, sort of a continuation on the main topic of our first hour last week. Keith, why don't you remind everybody what that was?
Well, what we're talking about is a movie, a premier movie that came out from Hollywood called The Blind Side that's based on a true story that occurred here in our hometown of Memphis, Tennessee. There's a couple, a white couple, a white fundamentalist so-called Republican couple, Sean and Leanne Toohey, who live in a McMansion, you know, one of these, you know, parvenu palaces. He is the franchise holder for Taco Bell and for Long John Silver's here, so he has over 70 restaurants, has money coming in, you know, so fast he doesn't know which pocket to put it in. His wife is a former Ole Miss cheerleader. He was a former Ole Miss basketball star. They have two lovely children of their own. But he's also a big athletic booster, and one of his jobs, apparently, self-appointed jobs, is to recruit black athletes to Briarcrest Baptist School, James's alma mater. And in doing this, they encountered this boy named Michael Orr from the ghettos of Memphis, a black kid. And there were TSSAA rules, Tennessee Secondary School Athletic Association rules, that said that if a kid comes to your private school on a scholarship, he has to refrain from playing sports. Now, if his parents or a close relative like a grandmother, grandfather, aunt, uncle, or something pays his tuition, that's fine. But if some third party pays his tuition, then he can attend school. He just can't play sports. And this was not a rule that was passed by racist white parents at these private schools trying to keep out black kids. It was initiated at the urging of public school coaches. And in Memphis, public school means a predominantly black school. They were tired of having their best athletes cherry-picked off, so they passed this law or rule for the TSSAA. So Toohey's grand plans were coming up against the immovable object, so he decided that the thing that he wanted to do to circumvent it was to adopt Michael Orr. And then this thing takes on a life of its own, and now they're this saintly, angelic couple reaching out in the true spirit of liberalism to help their black brethren.
Now, Keith, all that was a very eloquent recap, and we covered all that last week. But there were some new developments in the story that I know you particularly wanted to infuse into the program.
Well, I wanted to give the audience the background in case they didn't listen last week. But
right,
here's what we wanted to point out. You know, it's real easy to get, you know, lost for the forest for the trees. There seems to be, I've been watching with interest the general cultural reaction to this movie in movie reviews and things. I know you've been doing that too, Jane.
Right.
And basically it seems that people on the far right and on the left generally are very skeptical about this movie and its message. But there's this kind of great lump in the middle that seems to think this is a great feel-good story. And it's obvious to me, upon reflection, that this is a group that Hollywood intended to affect by this movie. This is who they're trying to do. These are the people whose minds they're trying to psychologically condition. And I think what they're trying to accomplish by this, if you want an analogy, it's like neoconservatism versus real conservatism. What is neoconservatism? Neoconservatism is an invention by blue state liberals to recreate, reinvent conservatism in terms they find acceptable. For example, a neoconservative is no different from a standard issue liberal on domestic issues like race and like affirmative action and like immigration and things like this. But in foreign policy, they try to get all this patriotic zeal and fervor of conservative people focused on wars in the Mideast, which coincidentally seem to help the state of Israel. Now, what they're trying to do in Blindside, in my opinion, they're trying to transform red state fundamentalist white people. You know, for the longest time, red state white Americans, particularly Southerners, were people beyond the pale. We were the hopeless racists and bigots of America. And basically, we just had to be neutralized. There was no way we were going to be offered forgiveness for our sins or the sins of our fathers or their imagined sins. Well, now they've come up with a formula for forgiving us. We can be like the Tuohys. To be like the Tuohys, one, you have to be incredibly wealthy. Two, you have to adopt some black child from the ghetto, disinherit your own children, and then promote this cowbird in the nest, so to speak, and his or her interests above those of your own biological children. If you do that, well, that's what the Tuohys are modeling. Then possibly you'll be given a pass, possibly you'll be forgiven, and possibly you can be a full participant in America, finally.
Well, Keith, I'll tell you this. Leanne Toohey, the woman in the whole picture, the woman who is played by Sandra Bullock in the movie, she was on a local Memphis talk show last week, and they really, really loved her. I mean, just fawning, just effusive praise, embarrassingly so.
She's our new role model.
You know, she hadn't done anything. She adopted a black kid because he could play football and, you know, made him look good. But here's the thing. They didn't, you know, and as you said last week, Keith, they didn't adopt a 4'11 sickly black child. They adopted someone who could be a star. But nevertheless, last week on one of the local, pop radio stations, they were just going on and on about how she showed them how they could be better people, how they could help ease race relations in Memphis, which, you know, is, God's almighty work being done manifest in front of us. But, you know, she has paved the way. She's a hero to them. And it just got, increasingly grotesque after that. But as you mentioned last week, Keith, you know, we started talking about this a week ago tonight, and now it seems as though everyone's talked about it or is talking about it currently.
See,
it seems as though that's the way it normally is with this program.
Yeah, we're on the cutting edge. But you see what this is. The TUIs were a bunch of athletic boosters, athletic supporters, you know, not a jock strap, but an athletic supporter, who basically had things spiral out of control, and they somehow were able to manage the spin to the point that rather than being seen as the ultra boosters they are, they became this saintly paragon of liberalism.
Hold that thought. We got to take a time out. We'll continue right after this.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages. Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397. We gotta get out of this place.
All right, continuing on with our continued coverage of the movie The Blind Side. It's important for several reasons, and we covered them extensively last week. We recapped them just a moment ago and are plotting some new ground right now. Interesting for a number of reasons. I went to the school there that this story originated at. And, Keith, you uncovered some more things with your great investigative work this week. And it's yet another contradiction, yet another hypocrisy. And we know that hypocrisy and contradictions reign on the left side of the political spectrum, or even the neoconservative side. Well, I would consider the TUIs to be leftists, to be honest with you. I know they parade around as Christian conservatives, but if this is what Christian conservatism has come to, I won't know part of it. But nevertheless, you found out that Leanne TUI, the woman in this picture, this true story, pretty much abandoned her father. And why did she do that, Keith?
Well, she, in the book, describes herself as coming from this virulent racist background. And her father was the primary virulent racist. Now, her father was a U.S. Marshal, which is kind of like a glorified court bailiff. They occasionally take federal prisoners from one district of the U.S. court system to another and things like this. But, you know, we're trying to figure out exactly what he did that would justify his daughter, who I'm sure was the apple of his eye, into throwing him under the bus. Now, did Mr. Collins, I think that was his her maiden name, did he ride with the Klan? Was he murdering civil rights workers in the South? Was he planting bombs in churches? Was he, riding shotgun with Byron Della Beckwith as he went down to assassinate Medgrevers? No. Apparently, his primary sin was that when the schools in their vicinity became thoroughly integrated by busing, he took her out of the public schools and put her into a private school. Can you imagine anything more shocking to the conscience than that?
All right, let me chime in on that, Keith. She, and as far as we know, this is seems to be the fact of the matter, she has nothing to do with her father, this being Leanne TUI. She has nothing to do with her father because he was a so-called racist, and the biggest example that he had of his racism was that he put her into a private school once forced integration and busing came into effect. Now, isn't it interesting that when they adopted this black kid, which is obviously the star of the movie and the star of the story, they didn't send him to the public schools. They sent him to Briarcrest, which was, of course, as we mentioned last week, perhaps the most prestigious private academy in the Mid-South, behind perhaps only Memphis University School. So they didn't send him to a public school. They sent him to a private school, the same private school, the same type of private school that her father sent her to, but that qualifies him as a racist, yet they're not racist for doing it themselves.
Yeah, it's
I don't
just
know,
a coincidence. It's just a coincidence that Briarcrest School apparently has a vastly predominant white student population.
Well, I can tell you, listen, I will tell you this. I went there through ninth grade, and this was in the mid-90s, so not too long ago, although it wasn't just yesterday either. Literally, there were three black kids in school. I mean, this was all the way up to 12th grade, three. And that's neither here nor there. I'm not saying that's Well, it certainly, you know, it didn't
bother me. Well,
you
talk about the emperor having no clothes,
but that's
James.
That was just the fact of the matter.
You know, you talk about the emperor having no clothes. Look at this. You know, Briarcrest Christian School started out as a segregation academy. You know, let's just tell it like it is. That it was founded in 1973 when the Plan Z busing order was handed down by the Western District of Tennessee District U.S. Court. And this is one of the things that basically led to the establishment of segregation academies in the Memphis, Tennessee area, and Briarcrest was one of them. Now, that's where she sends her children, but of course, she's this saint, and so is her husband. They're paragons. They have chosen to send their children to the same type of school that she found took issue with her father sending her to.
Well, you know,
maybe if he had adopted
a black kid and sent him to a private school, that would have absolved him of his sins. And that's what you're talking about, Keith. This seems to be the template or the blueprint that all red state Republicans can follow if they want to pardon themselves of their perceived sins, right? This is the way we got to act.
Dewey is a big fundamentalist. He is founded or is instrumental in the founding of a church called Grace Evangelical Church, which has all of these, you know, multicultural outreach programs if you check out their website. But this is, blue state America and Hollywood and our elites are always trying to find some way to remake us. And they have decided upon, apparently, the Tuies as being a model for remaking red state Americans, and particularly fundamentalist Christian red state Americans, into something that they can tolerate. And the way they can tolerate us is if we become the Tuies. And the Tuies are being held out as role models. And unfortunately, from some of the comments of people I heard leaving the movie theater, I think they're probably going to have some effect. I think there are going to be a lot of wannabe Tuies or copycat Tuies adopting kids just like Michael Orr.
Well, we'll wait to see. It'll be interesting if they all get movie deals out of it. I don't know.
Yeah, I doubt
but it's
certainly
the fashionable thing to do.
Deals.
I mean, you see Madonna doing it. You see Angelina Jolie doing it. I mean, and they are godlike now in terms of the gods of cultural Marxism. And so, you know, why wouldn't it trickle down to everyone? We're in a culture that's absolutely infested with bread and circus. And this is the way, you know, you can't be cool unless you adopt a cowbird, as you would call it, Keith.
Well, it's like, her father is a bigot and a racist because he believed in explicit whiteness. On the other hand, Sean and Leanne Tuohy believe in what Kevin McDonald and Jared Taylor and others call implicit whiteness, and they take a total pass. They're not thrown under the bus at all. In fact, they're elevated to sainthood, but they still send their kids to these virtually all-white segregated schools, and they're trying to, and it's like there's some cognitive dissonance here. You know, if multiculturalism and integration are that great, then why wouldn't Michael Orr have been better off going to some multicultural public school in Memphis? Because that's where the multiculturalism is, my friend. You know, if that's where...
Yeah, if diversity is so great and if diversity is such a strength, why wouldn't these parents, the Tuies, want him to enjoy that,
Leanne's father, when they sent him
to a public school, why did they deprive their son of the joys of an integrated school by sending him to Briarcrest? It seems as though that might be child abuse. See, I mean, that's what you get with political correctness. There's so many contradictions and double standards that they just trip over each other. I mean, so in a sense, Keith, if they truly do believe in what they say, they did him a disservice by sending him to the all-white $10,000 a year private school.
But
right?
They obviously, and everybody, even the people in Hollywood, recognize that they did not do him a disservice. They did him a great service by sending him to this virtually segregated all-white school.
Well, how could they do him a service by sending him to an all-white school when all-white is bad and diversity is what, you know, makes us so strong?
That's what I call cognitive dissonance. You know, there's something, you know, obviously the right side of the brain isn't talking to the left side. When you can actually believe stuff like that. And see, rather than, you know, Leanne Tuohy needs to realize her father's act was not an act of hate, but an act of love towards her. In fact, one of the climactic scenes, key scenes in the movie is when Leanne Tuohy goes to Michael Orr's birth mother to to get her approval for the adoption. And she is a crack addict and probably worse, probably a former prostitute or something like this. That's the implication in the movie. Doesn't even know for sure who the father of Michael Orr is. Well, you know what? If her father hadn't taken that step to send her to that segregation academy back in the 70s when she was growing up, she might have been visiting herself.
I like that, Keith. Absolutely.
You know, this is, you know, we need to stop lying to ourselves about issues like this. And Hollywood, in particular, has set up all these trap doors and all these false walls, Chinese walls, in between our thought processes. You know, if it was wrong for Leanne's father to send her to a segregation academy, then why is it right that Sean and Leanne not only do that for their children, but for this black kid?
And I think that, in so many words, is why Keith and I wanted to bring this to your attention. We felt as though it was incumbent upon us to revisit a story that we covered at length last week, kind of do a part two on our coverage of The Blind Side, because these double standards are something you need to be armed with. You need to know the facts behind this so you can pretty much just shoot them down in the water. I think you can make a compelling case that Tuwi's are evil for sending this guy to a pirate school because diversity is our strength, or so they say. We'll be back right after this.
Well, guys, we'll be back right after these messages.
We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life.
Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
I hope everybody is enjoying their extended holiday weekend this Saturday evening, November 28th, Thanksgiving weekend 2009. We were talking about that earlier in the program. The Christmas season is coming up. That means lots of shopping, and we're going to, in the second hour tonight, let you know of a place that will give you an opportunity to buy gifts with meaning and will allow your loved ones to showcase their Southern and Confederate pride. We're going to be talking with Scott Goldsmith, the owner of Dixie Republic in Travelers Rest, South Carolina. I've never heard of a town that sounds more Southern than Travelers Rest, South Carolina. And we're going to get a load of his inventory. We're going to let you, we're going to talk about a lot of things, Southern style. During the second hour, Winston Smith will be joining me as co-host the second hour. Bill Rowland has had a very hectic work schedule recently that has caused him to work on nights, Saturday nights. And Eddie Miller is hunting. I talked to Eddie earlier in the week, and he said he's been, and this is his exact words, and I quote, "I've been hunting my guts out, son." And anybody that knows the Bombardier knows that he's not exaggerating. He's been in a deer stand since late October, and he'll be back soon, though, and back on the show. But that's what everybody in the hosting staff is up to this evening. And that being said, I'll turn it back over to Keith Alexander, who's in studio with me tonight. Keith, you were watching the History Channel. I don't know why you would do that to yourself. I don't know if the History Channel has ever told a historical fact. They certainly don't do much for me when I watch them. But nevertheless, you came upon a story on the History Channel that you think would be good for commentary tonight on the show. What is it?
Well, to tell you the truth, it just knocked my socks off when I saw it. I think it's four or, you know, maybe it's a week or two-week show with hour-long segments, I think, on World War II. And what really, I just tuned it on kind of absentmindedly to see if there was anything of interest on there, and I swear, the first thing I saw was this fellow named Jack Werner, W-E-R-N-E-R, American, obviously Jewish descent, who was obviously an octogenarian or something, probably, and a veteran of World War II. And he was talking about this nomenclature that's used to describe the generation of World War II, the greatest generation. And he said, "I don't know whether it's proper to call us the greatest generation, because to be the greatest generation, you had to have some awareness of the social and political significance of what was going on. at that time. For example, he said, I was in a foxhole in France with this farm boy from Mississippi. Now, that farm boy didn't know anything about anything except his farm and the state of Mississippi. And I remember that he was shot right in the forehead and died there right in front of me. Now, was he a member of the Greatest Generation? I don't think so. And quite frankly, when I heard that, that just took my breath away. I said, can you believe this type of lack of camaraderie, this feeling of superiority that this fella had towards a comrade at arms who had just taken a bullet? Apparently he didn't know, he wasn't prescient enough or enlightened enough to know that World War II was not fought for freedom. It was not fought for putting an end to Nazism or to dictatorships or things like this. Instead, if he was really enlightened, he would have known it was about saving European Jewry and protecting the world against the effects of the Holocaust or something. Although he never said this, Warner never said that. But, you know, that lack of gratitude for a fellow soldier on his side who wound up paying the ultimate price, suffering the supreme sacrifice, basically to advance the interests of Jack Warner.
Well, this was, a WASP from Mississippi. And I'll tell you, you told me this earlier in the week in preparation for tonight's program, and hearing you say it again just makes me incensed all over again that he would have, that this Werner would have such a lack of respect for a man who was coming over there to fight, in my opinion, not for this country. No, America didn't want to get in that war. Everyone knows. We're not going to revisit all that. But before Pearl Harbor, nobody in America wanted to get in the war. We had people like Henry Ford and Charles Lindbergh doing great jobs with the America First Committee. That's neither here nor there. But here's this farm boy from Mississippi over there fighting in this war gallantly with valor. And he dies. And then this guy, this Werner, spits on his memory by saying he was just a dumb farmhand.
He's just a dumb hick. It reminds me of Henry Kissinger's comments about the typical rural white Americans that went to fight in Vietnam. He called them dumb brutes and more or less implied that whether or not they were killed didn't matter. You know, this is the most incredible. You know, the lack of gratitude just absolutely floors me when I hear it. You know, it's not often you hear it expressed so directly and succinctly as that, but when you do, it just takes your breath away.
Well, that's the thanks that our people got for doing what they did in World War II. The last time we did a real good segment on World War II was when Pat Buchanan was on this show in a much talked about interview to promote his book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. If you want to go back to our broadcast archives, I believe it was June of last year, listen to that interview that I did with Buchanan. Very good stuff if World War II history interests you, and that's a book you should read if this segment has piqued your interest. But certainly everyone, go back and listen to that interview I did with Pat, June of 2008, about a year and a half ago. So anyway, Keith, that being said, and like I said, I said tonight we're going to be a little bit focusing a little bit more on the lighter side. We're going to give folks a light helping of political commentary to go along with all that turkey. We didn't want to overstuff them any more than they've already done themselves. But bringing something like that up, I'll tell you what, that's heavy, and that's upsetting. And I don't want to be too upset tonight, but I tell you, it just goes to show, folks, what some people think about our family. And it's something that I think you should take note of, and that perhaps isn't the exception. But I'll let you be the judge of that. Keith, we got a book out. The Political Cesspool hosting staff, as you know, and Keith, you spearheaded this whole thing. It was your idea. It was your baby, and it turned out better than I expected. But it was a collaborative effort that we did. We want to give our members of the listening audience, our extended family, an opportunity to have a little booklet that we've put together that pretty much, I think, sums up the issues that we talk about on air. It's the perfect written supplement to what you hear every week on this program. It just puts into words what we say on air. And you can get it if you go to thepoliticalcesspool.org and make a donation to the program between now and Christmas Day as you go out and commence your Christmas shopping this year. Keep your friends at the Political Cesspool in mind. Remember that this show is listener-supported, and we need your financial considerations in order to stay on air. as we head into our sixth year of broadcasting. And if you want to make that happen, donate to the program, and we'll send you this book. It's entitled Liberalism and Its Effect on American Society. And, Keith, that's our incentive for people who will donate between now and Christmas. You'll get the book. Keith, I want you to tell them more about it, because it really is, you did such a remarkable job on it.
Well, it basically was a project that was commissioned by a mutual friend of ours named Bill Fox, who is an activist in the Republican Party who works, you know, in the nuts and bolts, you know, the nitty-gritty of political campaigns. And he said he was really tired of recruiting people for public office, spending blood, sweat, and tears, getting them elected, and then after they had proclaimed themselves to be good, sound conservatives, and then finding out once they got in office that they were anything but conservatives. He said, I'd love to have a template. I'd love to have a kind of touchstone that I could use to determine whether these people are really conservative or not. And he came up with this idea of seven pillars of civilization. I don't know where he came up with that idea, but we took it and ran with it. And basically what we've done is we have charted out what we consider to be the true conservative position on very important facets of our society and culture, like arts and entertainment, like the news media, like education, like civil government, like commerce and trade, things like this. I didn't give you a full listing of them, but that's the type of thing that, you know, we want to make sure that it's kind of like Ned and the Third Reader. We set out exactly what we consider to be the appropriate position for a conservative to have on these issues, and we explain it. We get into some historical background. We didn't want to lard it down with footnotes and make it into some intimidating scholarly treatise. We've tried to keep it down around 30 to 40 pages, but it's nonetheless what we think to be a great, you know, just like everybody carries around in their pocket a copy of the Constitution, or a lot of people do, we would love it if people carried this around in their pocket so they could confirm what the position of a true conservative should be on various topics they're liable to encounter in conversation with other people on a daily basis.
If you like the show, you're going to love the book. And I'm telling you that in all sincerity. I'm not trying to hawk something just because we did it. But this is the first incentive that we've offered over the course of our five-year history that we created. And you can get it if you donate to the program between now and Christmas Day.
And two to go.
We got to take a time out. We'll be back right after this.
Number two of the Political Cesspool comes your way right after these messages.
Harv leaped to his feet and said, something's got a hold on me. Yeah! The day the squirrel went berserk in the First Self-Righteous Church in that sleeping little town of Pascagoula. It was a fight for survival that broke out in revival. They were jumping pews and shouting hallelujah. Well, Harv hit the aisles dancing and screaming. Some thought he had religion, others thought he had a demon. And Harv thought he had a weed eater loose in his fruit of looms. He fell to his knees to plead and beg, and the squirrel ran out of his britches leg unobserved to the other side of the room. All the way down to the amen.